Before I begin tonight, I'd like to just ask for any information you might have. I have learned of two or three gospel preachers who are going to be visiting us next Sunday night, and we're going to plan to use them for 5 or 10 minutes, however many we have here. We'll determine that maybe, and sing some and have them make short talks. And if you know of a gospel preacher visiting from somewhere else that will be here with us next week, let me know about it, and we'll try to make arrangements to have them participate in that service. We always enjoy that, and I believe it's profitable too. I appreciate the prayer regarding the lessons on what Jesus would do. I think it's a very important question for us to ask under all circumstances. What would Jesus do when we have a decision to make? And I think the one tonight might be a particularly appropriate. What would Jesus do if the Super Bowl were being broadcast on a Sunday night at service time? But really, I don't guess there's any point in talking about that tonight, because you've already made your decision and you have acted on it in a very commendable way. I think we know what Jesus would do, and there's no need for me preaching to those who are not here. And so we'll take another route for our study tonight, and ask what Jesus would do under a variety of circumstances in which I suppose most of us find ourselves at one time or another. We're going to be reading a great deal tonight, particularly from the Gospel of Luke, though we will take one or two references from other books. But we'll go through the book, the life of Jesus, and view a number of circumstances that arose in his life, similar to those we face, and just see what Jesus would do under those circumstances. The first question I'm going to ask is this: what would Jesus do if he were entering his life's work? Now, we know that in the third chapter of the book of Luke, we have a record of the baptism of Jesus, which was not for the purpose of forgiveness of sins at all. For Jesus had no sins to be forgiven. He said rather that it was in order for him to fulfill all righteousness. John had come preaching in the wilderness, preparing the way of the Lord. And later the Lord was going to challenge the Pharisees because they had not submitted to the baptism of John. It was therefore fitting and necessary indeed that he should obey this command of God through John. For Jesus, however, it was primarily a commencement on his work. It was the beginning of what we sometimes call his personal ministry. In the verses that we have cited here, verses 21 and 22, we read that when all the people were baptized, it came to pass that Jesus also was baptized, and while he prayed, the heaven was opened, and the Holy Spirit descended in a bodily form like a dove upon him. And a voice came from heaven which said, "You are my beloved Son, in you I am well pleased." Jesus began his personal ministry, obviously, with baptism, which prepared him for a relationship with God, at least would prepare us for that in a very special way. The Holy Spirit came upon him, but I want you to observe that he was praying as he was baptized. What better way to begin one's life's work than with prayer? Now you might say, well, but Jesus' life's work was a work of preaching. My life's work is going to be the work of an engineer or a computer programmer or perhaps a mechanic or whatever else it might be. But I want to suggest to you that really that should not be our life's work. Someone has well said that all those things should simply be our avocation. Our vocation, our calling, is to be servants of God. And in preparation for whatever we intend to do, prayer is most certainly in order. All of us face sometimes some extremely busy days. And at the close of the day, we're extremely weary. What do you do at the close of a very busy day? One of my favorite texts is found in the book of Mark. It was a kind of a favorite text before I had the opportunity to go to Israel. But after visiting there, it has had special meaning for me. In the first chapter of the book of Mark, we have recorded a couple of days, a weekend of Jesus, we might call it. And the first thing that seems to have happened was that on Friday, he called his fishermen, friends, to follow him and be his disciple. On Saturday, which would have been the Sabbath, they were up in time to go to synagogue worship, which usually took place about 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. Jesus went into the synagogue, and there he spoke. And while he was there, a man interrupted the service who had an evil spirit. And Jesus cast the demon out of this man in the middle of the synagogue service. Well, you can rather imagine the emotion that stirred. And then he went home with Peter in Capernaum, and he found Peter's mother-in-law was sick. In fact, they were even despaired of her life, Luke tells us. And so he raised her from her illness so that she could serve them. And when the sun was set, the word about this wonderful healing and the word about the events in the synagogue had spread, so that we're told in verse 32 that at evening when the sun had set, they brought to him all who were sick and those who were demon-possessed, and the whole city was gathered together at the door. You can just picture that scene. And he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he did not allow the demons to speak because they knew him. Can you just imagine how weary he must have been when he and Peter and the others of the family finally retired to sleep that night? Well, what do you do the next day? I kind of like to sleep in myself. But in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and departed into a solitary place. And there he prayed. After a long day of work, he sensed the need for communion with God. I don't know that he had anything to ask for, but he just wanted to talk to his Father. And another passage tells us he went up into the mountain to pray. One of the things that moved me thinking about this text was standing up on a hillside and looking down at Capernaum. And sure enough, right up there behind it was the hill, the type of mountain into which he could so easily go a great while before day and pray. But what about the midst of great activity? When you find yourself extremely busy, not just for one day, but day after day. In the fifth chapter of the book of Luke, we find Jesus in such a situation. He had healed, and because of the healing of this leper, the word just spread everywhere and people thronged about him. We're told in verse 15 that the report went around concerning him all the more, and great multitudes came together to hear and to be healed by him of their infirmities. And he himself often withdrew into the wilderness and prayed. What do you do when you just get so busy you don't have time to pray? Well, you take time to pray if you follow the example of Jesus. It is such an important part of your life that even if you don't have time to eat, you find the time to pray. It may be that you don't have time to go into a solitary place. That's one of the sad things about living in cities. That may be the circumstances under which Jesus said, go into the closet and close your door. Find some place that you can be alone and pray to God for whatever time may be available, even in the midst of a busy, hectic day. You may find more relief from the anxiety and the tension than you ever dreamed was possible by prayer. But when you find yourself just covered up, ask yourself, what would Jesus do? And he'd take a few moments and pray. All of us from time to time face some major decisions. It may be a decision as small as buying an automobile. I can get all up in the air about that. I can just get really, but that really is a minor decision. There are such more important decisions than that we make. It may be buying a house, and that's a longer range kind of decision. But even far more important than that is the decision, for example, of who you will marry. Or it may be a decision relating to a business partnership that can have a great effect on your life, can influence you tremendously. It may be some decision regarding your location of work or the work you will do for the next few years or what you'll major in school as you prepare your life work that you will enter. What do you do when you have big decisions like that to make? Well, look at the 6th chapter of the book of Luke. Begin reading with me at verse 12. It came to pass in those days that he went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called his disciples to him, and from them he chose 12, whom he also named apostles: Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, Simon called the Zealot, Judas the son of James, and also Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. He was going to choose his apostles. So much hung upon that choice, that decision. And he prayed all night long before he made that decision. It would be a terrible thing to choose a marriage companion without prayer. Prayer day after day. It's not too early when children begin to pray, to teach them to pray that God will give them a good companion for life. Perhaps nothing else influences us as much as that. Pray about your life companion. Pray about your business associates. Pray about decisions you make of that kind. And you'll find God helping you. The very act of prayer will help to focus your mind on those things that really matter in the making of such decisions. This may be a small question to ask, but let me ask you, what do you do before eating? In the 9th chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus was about to feed 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. It was not simply that he was concerned about whether he could multiply it or not. Of course he was not. But in many instances, in fact, I think most every instance where any detail is given about Jesus eating, he did the same thing. Verse 16 says, he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke them and gave them to the disciples to set before the multitude. Some other accounts simply say that he prayed. In this case, he blessed it, but he blessed it by giving thanks for it. Food is not blessed until we give thanks to God for it. So as little a thing as when you prepare to eat, ask yourself, what would Jesus do? But this is a very small amount. This is just a refreshment. But what would Jesus do? I rather suspect he'd thank God for whatever he ate. There are times when we have to make a rather shocking revelation to somebody. It may be the revelation that someone has died in the family. It may be the revelation that some kind of major change is about to take place in their life. It may be that we have to reveal to them that their conduct is totally unacceptable as far as God's people are concerned. There are numerous times we have to make such announcements. What would Jesus do in advance to make preparation for making such an announcement? Turn to the 9th chapter. And let's read several verses here, beginning with the 18th verse of Luke 9. It came to pass, as he was alone praying, his disciples were with him, and he asked them, saying, who did the crowd say that I am? They answered and said, John the Baptist, but some say Elijah, and others say that one of the old prophets is risen again. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered and said, the Christ of God. And he strictly warned them and commanded them to tell this to no one. Peter must have been excited to be able to make that statement. You are the Christ. You are the Messiah. You are the Son of God. And doubtless Peter conjured up pictures of great honor for Jesus and incidentally for Peter too and for these other companions with whom he was associated. He couldn't dream of the Messiah being anything but an earthly king. But Jesus said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. And he said to them all, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it." Bear a cross every day? Lose our lives? That's not the reason we're following you. You're the King. You're the Messiah. Jesus must have recognized that this would come as a great shock to them. In fact, Matthew tells us that Peter said, "Oh, this is not going to happen to you." Jesus realized that this was a totally different direction from what they had anticipated their lives would follow in following him. And he prayed before he revealed this shocking news to these disciples. I'm a little uncertain about whether to say that Jesus was depressed, but it was still while he was up there in the mountains having revealed this to the disciples that we read about him in the 9th chapter of Luke, praying through the night. In verse 28 it says, "It came to pass about 8 days after these sayings that he took Peter, John, and James and went up into the mountain to pray. And when he took those three particularly, there was usually something of significance that was about to take place, something that was rather personal that was about to take place. As he prayed, the appearance of his face was altered, and his robe became white and glistening, and behold, two men talked with him who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his decease, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem." I think it was weighing on his mind. Jesus was God, yes, he was divine, and he had come into this world to die, but there was humanity there also. He was a man, and as time went on, the shadow of the cross became darker and darker over his pathway. And then this moment that he was aware of the future that lay before him, he took these men with him and spent his time in prayer. What do you do when you hear good news, wonderful news? Well, what would Jesus do? In the 10th chapter of the book of Luke, we find Jesus sending the 70 out and giving them power over evil spirits and telling them to preach that the kingdom of heaven was at hand. And verse 17 says, "The 70 returned with joy, saying, 'Lord, even the demons are subject to us through your name.'" And then look at verse 21. "In that hour, Jesus rejoiced in spirit and said, 'I thank you, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and prudent and revealed them unto babes. For even so, Father, it seemed good in your sight.'" When something good happens, thank God. Express your awareness that God is the source of these blessings. Can you imagine Jesus doing any other thing? What do you do when little children are seen, perhaps for the first time? Or when they begin to tug at your heartstrings as you see them, perhaps in their mother's arms? In the book of Matthew, the 19th chapter, beginning with verse 13, we're told that little children were brought to him that he might put his hands on them and pray. But the disciples rebuked them. They thought Jesus didn't have time for little children. But Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me and do not forbid them, for if such is the kingdom of heaven." And he laid his hands on them and departed from there. And you wouldn't know from this whether he prayed or not, but Mark says he blessed them. He laid his hands on them and blessed them, doubtless, with the very prayer that these mothers had desired. What wonderful thing it is to hold in your arms a little one who has so recently come from heaven, from the hand of God. At the same time, how difficult it is sometimes to realize what they're going to have to face, what lies in the future for them. What would Jesus do? Jesus would pray for them. What do you do when a friend faces temptation? All of us have seen friends go into places where they would be tempted, perhaps pursue occupations that are going to tempt them, perhaps move into some distant place where the church is very weak, and where they may not have the Christian friends that they have to encourage them. When we see such a thing happening, what would Jesus do? Well, in Luke 22, verses 31 and 32, as Jesus recognized what was going to lie before Peter, he said, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked to have you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brethren." That's what Jesus would do. He would pray for those that are tempted. Have you ever had the experience of having to leave people that you love? Maybe move away from a congregation that you love very dearly. Or perhaps leave your family for a period of time to be gone, to be separated from them. What would Jesus do if he were leaving a congregation of people? I find myself doing that rather often during the year. As I spend a week with a congregation of people that I love and appreciate and have come to respect so highly, and often they're people I've never known before, but within the week they become dear friends. I've been in their home. They've listened to me for a total of several hours time during that week. And I'm bidding them goodbye. What would Jesus do? Well, in the 17th chapter of John, we learn exactly what Jesus would do. Here Jesus, after telling Peter that he was going to deny him, and having gone out in toward the garden, not yet in the garden, somewhere along the way, whether it was still in the upper room or out there on the path leading to the Garden of Gethsemane, he offered what may truly be spoken of as the Lord's Prayer. There were first words concerning himself and the Father. But beginning with verse 6, he said, "I have manifested your name to the men who you gave me out of the world. They were yours, you gave them to me, they have kept your word. Now they have known that all things which you have given me are from you. I have given to them the words that you gave me, and they have received them, and have known surely that I came forth from you, and have believed that you sent me." Then verse 9, "I pray for them. I do not pray for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. All mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them." He prays for them. And he not only prays for them, but for those who they are going to influence. That would be you and me. He prayed for us. He prayed that we might be united, that in love we might work together through our confidence in him and by our loyalty and faith in him, letting him be our ruler and our guide as the one who came into this world as God's revelation to us. But what do you do when you're facing death? All of us will face it someday. And the older we get, I think, the more conscious we are of the fact that it lies before us. In the 22nd chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus knew that death was imminent. Not because he was getting older, he was in the very prime of life, but because he had served God as God had sent him to serve. Because he had been righteous when the world around him was unrighteous. He had maintained truth while others were pursuing falsehood. Beginning in verse 39 of the 22nd chapter of Luke, we read that coming out, that is, of the upper room, he went to the Mount of Olives, and as he was accustomed, his disciples also followed him. And when he came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you do not enter into temptation." And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and prayed, saying, "Father, if it is your will, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." There appeared an angel to him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. And he said to them, "Why do you sleep? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation." This is an interesting test for you and me. What would we be doing under these circumstances? What Jesus was doing, or what the disciples were doing? Would we be praying as Jesus prayed, or sleeping as the disciples were sleeping? Jesus indicated that they too were facing a great trial, a great test. They were oblivious to it. They didn't understand it. They were sleeping while Jesus was praying. And it may be the difference in difference in their approach to this crisis made the difference between their action in the crisis. Jesus went forth firmly, faithfully, courageously to the cross. They fled. They ran away. They had slept in the time of prayer. Jesus had prayed when the others were sleeping. What do you do when you're mistreated? What would Jesus do? We talked about that this morning. We'll not belabor the point. You're quite familiar with the words of Jesus recorded by Luke again in the 23rd chapter of the book of Luke and verse 34. Whereas Jesus perhaps was being nailed to the cross, certainly as he was suffering the agony of the cross, he prayed, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." And what do you do when you're dying if you do what Jesus did? Some might not have the opportunity, but if the opportunity is there to know the moment when we're passing on, what would Jesus do? He would say, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." What would Jesus do in every crisis of life? Not simply once in the evening, not simply three times a day when he's eating a meal, but again and again and again through the day, and again and again and again through the night, Jesus prayed. And when we come face to face with this, it seems to me that we are able to strip from our profession those things that are purely outward and ask ourselves, am I truly like Jesus? You know, we can get pretty proud of ourselves because, well, we've been baptized. And look at all of those millions of people out there that haven't been baptized. And among those that have, look how many have been unscripturally baptized. And we can get pretty proud of ourselves because I come to services every Sunday. And sometimes Sunday night. And even Wednesday night. And we can become to feel pretty good about ourselves because we contribute rather liberally, and the IRS is amazed that we give as much as we give. I'm not objecting to any of that. All of that is necessary. And all of that, I believe, would be our response to the question, what would Jesus do? I know he'd be baptized. I know he would attend the worship. I know he would give liberally. I know he would. But he would also pray and pray and pray and pray. And if I'm not a prayerful person, I still am not really like Jesus as I ought to be. I can't truly say that he has become the real hero, the real model after whom my life is patterned. I'd like to encourage us all to be impressed with the prayer life of Jesus Christ and seek in our desire to be like him in other things, to be like him in prayer. Take out this little song again, if you would, please. And I think we're just going to sing the first half of it or so. Down to the point, I want my heart his throne to be. We won't sing that, as valuable as it is. The rest.
I have one deep, supreme desire that I may be like Jesus. To this I fervently aspire, that I may be like Jesus.
Let's sing it again and see if we can memorize it.
I have one deep, supreme desire, that I may be like Jesus. To this I fervently aspire, that I may be like Jesus.
I want to confess, but I have a motive in singing this song again and again. You know, when God was instructing the children of Israel, Moses particularly, as to how he was to impress upon them some truth, God told Moses to teach them this song. They didn't have the scriptures in written form so that they could read it again and again and again. But they could learn a song and it would stay with them. The easiest way to memorize words are to put them in a song. That's the reason that children can sing Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They learn it with a tune. And I would just like to hope that as we go over and over and over this song, and we'll do it another time or two, it might become so familiar to us that when we are faced with a temptation and we realize what Jesus would do, but we're tempted to say, but that's not practical. That was 2,000 years ago. It's hard. People will laugh at me. People won't like it. I just would like for you to think of this song. I have one sweet, deep, supreme desire
that I may be like Jesus. To this I fervently aspire, that I may be like Jesus.
That your heart's desire? That's the real test, whether we're Christians or not. If you haven't obeyed the gospel of Christ, you can't be like Him. He has to make you like Him by His grace, by His mercy. But He does so with your cooperation as you look to Him as your Lord and Master. And if you believe in Him as the Son of God and are willing to turn from sin, which keeps you from being like Him, if you're willing to be baptized, do you not know that as many of us as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ? That's the way we put Him on. That's the way we become like Him. And then by following Him day by day and learning to ask, what would He do? And if enough times in our life we ask what He would do, there comes a time when we will just naturally do what He would do, even without having to think about it consciously. If there's someone who would obey the gospel of the Lord tonight, we'd urge you to come and let us assist you as we stand and sing.